Time now for the latest world sport from the BBC with me, Ed Harry. Coming up, Australia's cricketers have won the first test against New Zealand in Wellington. South Africa must do well on the pitch if the World Cup's to be a success. That's according to the head of the local organising committee. And the French Open tennis could be leaving Roland Garros. First, though, to Wellington, where Australia have won the first test against New Zealand by 10 wickets on the final day. Following on, the hosts resumed earlier on 369 for 6, but they were all out for 407, leaving the Australians to score 106 for the win, which they did before lunch. With the details, our reporter at the Basin Reserve, Brian Waddle.
They achieved the victory with almost indecent haste. Well, Philip Hughes did, because he was the dominant feature of the Australian chase for that 106. Unfortunately for New Zealand, they couldn't revive their resistance of day four when only one wicket was lost, and they added only 38 runs to the total today before they were finally dismissed. Brendan McCullum finishing with his fifth test 100, 104, but he was the only real resistance then when the New Zealand innings fell apart and they were out just after passing the 400 mark. Australia had had the performance of Hughes and Cattett to get them through right on the stroke of lunch to win the game, and they dominated the match. Michael Clarke was named player of the game. They go to Hamilton for the second test with a 1-0 lead.
Many thanks to Brian Waddle. There's also test cricket being played in Dhaka, where 2 days remain in the second and final match of Bangladesh's home series against England. The tourists, who won the first test, will start the fourth day there on 440 for 8 in their first innings. That's an overall lead of 21 runs. With less than 3 months to go before the start of the Football World Cup, the head of the local organising committee in South Africa has been stressing how important it is that the host nation does well on the field. Danny Jourdan says South Africa's players need to make an impact.
We recognise that the home team must perform. We would like our team to perform. They have gone into camp now, and they will be in camp for the next 2 months. So we'll try our best to put together a team that can compete. You're quite correct. It's important that the host nation's team must perform. And we're keeping our fingers crossed for the team to at least go to the second round. But we also said this is an African World Cup. And so it's not just the performance of our own team, but the performance of all of the African teams that we are concerned with. We had 3 meetings already with all the African teams that have qualified to see how we can work together to make sure that all of the teams will be ready for a very, very difficult group that they all have been drawn into. We expect teams like Nigeria, Cameroon, Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana, as well as Algeria and South Africa, to perform well, and look forward to have one or two in the finals.
FIFA, the game's world governing body, will convene a disciplinary panel on April the 15th to examine the disturbances which occurred ahead of the World Cup qualifier between Egypt and Algeria in Cairo last November. Algeria's players and officials said they were showered with broken glass when home supporters hurled rocks at their team bus 2 days before the match. BBC's Richard Fleming has covered 5 Africa Cup of Nations tournaments. I asked him why it's taken FIFA so long to convene this meeting.
That's a good question. Of course, there is history between the two footballing nations. This incident, in fact, triggered violence in both Cairo and Algiers. Talks were even held at senior diplomatic level. So I think in FIFA's defence, they are wary of the sensitivity. There's been accusations and counter-accusations, which I think will have clouded the investigations of FIFA. And, of course, both nations were involved in the Africa Cup of Nations during January. So that took them out of the equation. Indeed, of course, they met at the semi-final stage in Angola when Egypt's Mohamed Zidane referred to the meeting as war. But I think, as you intimated there, it has dragged on a bit. It appears that security was nowhere near tight enough to greet the Algerian team. That's just from what we've heard from the players. It's hard to see how the Algeria delegation could be responsible unless FIFA deem that they incited trouble. Possible punishments? Well, in these cases, normally a fine or matches behind closed doors. So that's about as severe as it gets.
CSKA Sofia must play their next 3 matches at a neutral venue following a pitch invasion during their Bulgarian league match at Lokomotiv Mezdra at the weekend. The punishment was imposed after more than 100 CSKA fans stormed the field soon after the home side took the lead midway through the second half. It forced the referee to abandon the match. The French Tennis Federation has admitted the French Open could be at risk of failing to attract the world's top players if it doesn't expand and move to a bigger venue. The Australian and US Opens have all developed significantly over the past 20 years, and Roland Garros is now the only Grand Slam event without a covered court. The Federation is looking at four different projects, which include enlarging the existing site and moving to a new venue outside Paris. And Gilles Berry-Sen, the Federation's General Director, has told the BBC World Service they've got to move forward.
The two main major concerns being, first, the lack of a roof on at least one of our center courts. Wimbledon has a roof now, as you know. The Australian Open has two. We really need one in the near future. And the other thing is we are really short of space, and we need to have more space dedicated to the players and their entourage, more space for our crowds on site. And so we really have a lack of space. In the long run, if we don't do what we have to do, we run the risk that the players might be more reluctant year after year to coming to Paris. And in the long term, and I insist on that, in the long term, we could put the tournament at risk.
The number of tickets available for the 2012 Olympic Games here in London has been increased by 300,000 to a total of 8 million. Registrations also formally opened for tickets, which won't go on sale until next year. But it's not yet known how many of those public tickets will be for the most sought-after events. There's concern over how many tickets will go to members of the public and how many to sponsors, and whether ticket buyers from the host nation will enjoy any kind of priority. Here's BBC Radio's Olympic correspondent, Gordon Farker.
What they're saying is that 75% of tickets will be kept for sale for the general public. Some will go to the Olympic family, some will go to sponsors. But what they can't say is how many of those reserved tickets will be available for things like the final of the 100 metres or the big nights in the swimming pool. The other problem is they have to make tickets equally available to all member states in the European Union. That's one of the EU laws. So they can't really guarantee how many of this 75% of tickets will find their way into the hands of British people.
Harry Carpenter, the BBC sports commentator and presenter, has died at the age of 84. He covered every Olympic Games from 1956 to 1992, but it's for his boxing commentaries that he'll be best remembered. In a moment, BBC Radio's current boxing commentator, Mike Costello, with his reflections on Carpenter's career. But here's the man himself, ringside, describing the moment Muhammad Ali knocked out George Foreman to regain the heavyweight championship of the world.
And he's out! Oh my God, he's won the title back at 32! And everybody is fighting to get into the ring now. Ali is heavyweight champion of the world at 32 in the eighth round by a knockout.
The words of Harry Carpenter embellished the deeds of many top boxers, including the greatest of them all, Muhammad Ali. The commentary on Ali's rumble in the jungle against George Foreman in 1974 is replayed as much as any other. He's also revered for his post-fight interviews with Frank Bruno, with almost every answer ending in the phrase, "You know what I mean, Harry." His joshing with Bruno underlined the respect boxers had for him, and Carpenter's versatility meant he also presented some of the BBC's flagship sports programmes, like Grandstand and Sports Night, as well as coverage of golf, the boat race and Wimbledon.
Mike Costello there, and many boxers have been paying their own tributes to Harry Carpenter, among them George Foreman.
He was really a classy human being, always a good smile, so much class he brought to the sport of boxing. I can remember shocking him beyond all means when I defeated Joe Frazier. My first time meeting Harry Carpenter was in Kingston, Jamaica. Nobody gave me much of a chance, but oh boy, I shocked him. That's my fondest memory.
George Foreman remembering his first meeting with Harry Carpenter, the BBC sports commentator and presenter who's died at the age of 84. Much more on the life of Harry Carpenter on our website. That address for you, as always, bbcworldservice.com. That's the latest world sport.